Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2018, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, the Santa Clara County Library District, San Jose Public Library, De Anza College, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Mary Ann DeWan, and I am the Interim County Superintendent of Schools for the Santa Clara County Office of Education and one of the co-chairs of the Silicon Valley Reads Initiative. The theme of Silicon Valley Reads in 2018 is, no matter what, caring, coping, compassion. And it is my pleasure to introduce the authors of this year's Silicon Valley Reads featured books, Rachel Kong and Mark Lukacs. Mark Lukacs is the author of My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, an inspiring memoir that developed out of a magazine article he wrote in the New York Times about his wife's experience with mental illness and how it affected their marriage and family. It became an international bestseller after its publication in 2017. Mark juggles family life and writing with his full-time job as ninth grade dean and history teacher at the Athenian School in Danville. Rachel Kong is the author of Goodbye Vitamin, her debut novel that was named a best book of 2017 by NPR, Oprah, Vogue, Esquire, Huffington Post, Entertainment Weekly, Booklist, and others. She holds degrees from Yale University and the University of Florida, and for 6 years, she was managing editor and then executive editor of the food magazine Lucky Peach. She now lives in San Francisco. And moderating tonight's conversation is Sal Pizarro, columnist for the Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mark Lukacs, Rachel Kong, and Sal Pizarro. Right.
Thank you, everyone, and thank the two of you for joining us here tonight to kick off this year's program. It is always an exciting moment when we start a new year for Silicon Valley Reads and we get to dig into some books and a new theme. So it is really an honor to have both authors here with us tonight. The stars don't always align that way, but we did just have the super blue blood moon, so I think that helped. Now, we have two very different books that work along our theme of no matter what, about caregiving and compassion. Mark, your book is a memoir, and we were talking a little bit earlier about the difference between a memoir and an autobiography, and I'm sure we'll be getting into that. And Rachel, of course, your book is a novel, which means you've got to make it up, but it's, you know, based on some real events that have happened in your life. So I'd love to hear from both of you, if you could share with our audience your journey as writers and how you sort of got to the point where you had a book inside of you that needed to get out. Rachel, would you like to start?
Sure. I guess my journey as a writer started when I was a little kid, actually. You know, I have always been a big reader, loved books that sort of transported me into another world. And I knew, I think, starting from maybe age six that I wanted to write a book of my own. Took a while. Did not...
You had other things to do.
Though. I had other things going on, including, you know, growing up. So I couldn't, you know, as much as I wanted to write a novel at age six, it did not happen. But yeah, so, you know, my journey was sort of learning how to do that. It's actually not quite as easy as just making things up, I found out. You know, I had to sort of learn by reading, learn by figuring out what the story was that I wanted to tell, and I think that was what took years, was just kind of finding my voice, finding the right story and the way in which to tell it. That's a short answer, yeah.
And what writers influence you? I mean, who
yeah.
do you read?
I read, at the very beginning, books like A Wrinkle in Time, I loved, or
like... My daughter just finished it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that period of time in your life when you're just discovering books and how special and magical they can be, that was really, I think, transformative for me. Lately, next on my list is my lovely wife in the psych ward, but...
That's the easy answer, and it's a good answer.
Yeah.
So, Mark, what were your writing influences? Did you write a lot growing up, or was this something that just sort of came?
No, I'm still getting used to identifying as a writer. I'm a teacher at my core. I didn't know that I would write a book. I didn't really think about it that way. But my life took quite the unexpected turn when my wife got sick. And I'm a big reader, and as a history teacher, I'm a researcher. So when she was sick, I was immediately went to the internet to try to find narratives that might help me make sense of things. And I found a lot of narratives about what she was going through, but I found almost nothing about what it was going to be like for me. Mm-hmm. And I felt this profound loneliness as a result. I mean, I knew I wasn't the first partner to love someone who had a mental illness, and yet I couldn't find someone who I could talk to about it or even just hear from them through a book. So I wouldn't say that I got the idea immediately, because I certainly wasn't thinking on those levels. But I started to write these really long emails to my parents and to her parents to kind of give them updates on how Julia was doing with her health. And she was, when she was really heavily medicated, she was falling asleep really early, like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And I'd have all this time to just sort of stir. And the writing became a way for me to make sense of what had happened in the day. And I found it to be incredibly therapeutic for me. And then when she got better and I was trying to help her understand what I went through, her reading some of those letters really helped us to become closer around how to process this trauma together. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of grew from there, this idea that, you know what, this is an underserved narrative that maybe is worth trying to share with the world, you know? And I got really lucky. I submitted to the Modern Love column in the New York Times, and they accepted it. And then I got even luckier when I wrote this magazine article that... I hate to use the word, but it went viral, you know? And it was widely read across the internet, and that led to me getting an agent and a publisher, and so now I have a book.
And this is really the third iteration of this story for you.
Well, my wife has been hospitalized 3 times, which changed. Each of those is quite different. I wrote in the New York Times after her first hospitalization with the idea of maybe trying to get a book published then, but nothing came of it. And I think, kind of on a larger scale, it's because the story wasn't done with me yet. I didn't know yet that she was, that her episode wasn't one and done like we hoped. It was actually a diagnosis of bipolar, which is recurring and might continue to come back. So I actually kind of gave up on trying to write the book until this editor approached me after reading the Modern Love column and said, hey, would you want to write a piece together? And that really led to the creation of the magazine article and then the book.
Great. Now, there's both of your books deal with memory. There's a lot of memory and what it means in your book, Rachel. What kind of research did you do into memory and Alzheimer's?
Yeah, as Mark was talking about, just the story emerging and the story, not quite being ready until it was ready. I think to your earlier question too of when did you come up with the story? When did the story kind of make mm-hmm. itself known. I realized sort of along the way as I was writing and trying to write that I had these really persistent obsessions, I guess. Mm-hmm. And one of them, a big one for me, is memory and is just the fact that we all kind of live our lives with this really faulty memory, and memories are so imperfect, and what that kind of means for relationships between people and how there can be misunderstandings and just a lack of like perfect communication. And that was something I still really think about constantly, just the heartbreak inherent in that. So when I approached writing this book, you know, there were so many things that I wanted to explore when it came to memory, just the faultiness, but also some of the more researched aspects are like the science behind it. What's happening when you remember something? Why is it not completely right? And so, yeah, the research that I did was a lot of, I did, you know, some lurking on forums of caregivers. Mm-hmm. I had, again, like you sort of touched on, like some firsthand experience because my grandmother had Alzheimer's. And so the research was happening throughout the process of writing the book. Sometimes it's hard to just sit down and make stuff up, and I would sort of fill that in with like trying to learn more about this mysterious thing.
And a lot of that does show up in your writing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very seamless. It doesn't seem like research. It seems like, you know, we're living it along mm-hmm. with the characters and saying, oh, that's what that's like. Mm-hmm. But and when you talk about memory, those of you who've been with Silicon Valley Reads in the past, and I'm speaking to the audience here, will remember last year we had one of our authors spoke on criminal injustice and how eyewitness memories are really faulty.
Yeah.
And he talked a lot about how what we think we remember isn't always the case.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to think about how we remember things.
I was also really interested in, you know, the memory that happens between, just the relationship between parents and children, how parents have memories of their child that the child doesn't even have access to, know, anymore. Your parents remember swatches of time that you have no access to whatsoever, and yet their memories of you inform what they feel about you.
Now, there's passages in your book where there's the list that the Father Howard, you know, has kept mm-hmm. of today you asked this question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And did that come from a real place? Was that something that had actually happened? Or
that wasn't something that actually happened, but I was very interested in, Mark and I were talking about this earlier, just the things that you write down and often can be very arbitrary, but the things that you write down do sometimes wind up being the things that you remember because you've committed them to paper, whatever they are, and it's almost like taking a picture. You're, you know, choosing to recall something very specific. And mm-hmm. so that was a question, another question that I've thought a lot about. And
what we choose to recall.
What we choose to recall, yeah.
Now, on the other hand, Mark, your book, while dealing with, has a lot of memories in it, including your experience with our mental health system. There's some thoughts in there. Well, what are your thoughts on our... could you share with the audience your thoughts on our mental health system and perhaps how we can do a better job,
sure.
both for the people it's caring for and the people caring for them?
Yeah, I want to be cautious that I don't want to at any point feel as if I'm discrediting those who work in the system. I really don't think it's a problem of the individuals. I think it is a systemic problem where the gaps come in. But the frustrations that I found in our mental health system are manyfold. First off, it's a lot about Band-Aid solutions. It's about stabilizing, and then that's it. Just get people so that they're safe enough that they can go back to their lives, not necessarily healthy and well enough to do so. I would say the biggest frustration I found is that our system diagnoses one person with the diagnosis and they treat it as if that is the only person who experiences that diagnosis, which is obviously wrong because each of us are so interconnected with various people in various ways, right? My wife being diagnosed with bipolar obviously had a profound effect on me, but had an effect on her parents and my siblings and her siblings and our friends. But they don't care about that. They just deal with Julia. And so I often felt like I was being kept at arm's length. And I understand why, because there's a really tragic history of how the mentally ill have been treated by doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I was so desperate to help. I so badly wanted to be included in the process, but they didn't really make space for me to do so. Like I said, Julie's been hospitalized 3 times. That was over a 5-year period. It wasn't until her 3rd hospitalization that a doctor asked me how I was doing, you know, which was like, really? There's no space. And in fact, I called my insurance provider after the day she was first hospitalized, and I said, my wife's having a psychotic break. I really would like to speak to a therapist. And they said, well, we're sorry, you don't have a diagnosis, so we can actually only cover 30 minutes of therapy a month for you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I just decided I'm going to pay out of pocket because I need this support. I can't go through this without talking to somebody. So I would say what to do, it needs to be more holistic. It needs to be more patient. The system needs to be patient with the people who are supposed to be patient. You know, it's kind of a one-way demand of, hey, we're going to try all these meds and you just have to wait it out. But as soon as we find it, see ya. You know, and I just wish there was more time dedicated. And I know that all means a lot more money, but it would save lives and it would keep families together. So I think it's worth it.
And it seems like your own attitudes about some treatments changed over the course of seeing
Absolutely. Things happen. Absolutely. Yeah, I started really willing to follow every doctor's order. And I thought I was like the good soldier standing alongside them. And unfortunately, that was really difficult for my wife because she felt like I was not on her side. I was on their side. And I had to do things which I knew in the time were really hard to do, like force her to take medication and stuff like that. But I thought I was doing the right thing. And it took until subsequent episodes for me to really value that even though she may have been psychotic and in an altered state, I still needed to listen to her. I still need to dignify her experience, mm-hmm. make her feel included in her care, not just her against the doctor and by extension me. And so, yeah, my relationship with psychiatry is actually still in flux. Like, I still sometimes kind of depends on the time and the experience for, like, how I feel about it.
And if anything, when we were having a little discussion earlier, that you become something of an advocate now.
I think I've become an advocate for caregiving. I think I want caregivers to know that there are others out there who go through the same thing, who need to make space to take care of themselves. There's so many competing things for your time when you're trying to take care of someone who's really vulnerable, and no one reminds you have to take care of yourself. But I also feel like I'm an advocate for the concept of family and that tragedies will strike all of our families, but if you can have what I phrase it as the courage to listen to each other, meaning to really hear how things feel, even if they're really difficult to hear, that family can be a force of strength that can help to navigate tragedies.
Sounds great. Now, Rachel, one of your, you know, Ruth, your main character, one of our caregivers, she is a very complicated person. She's got a lot going on in her life.
Yeah.
She's back home with her parents and leaving a bad situation in San Francisco. Who knew there were bad situations in San Francisco, right? I think people are wondering, how much of you is in Ruth? And, you know, is there some of that?
Yeah, that's a question. Well, so, you know, it is fiction.
It is fiction.
You know, that's interesting because back to that question of why did you want to write? When did you find this story? I think I had been writing for years in the third person stories about characters that seemed very different from myself. You know, maybe it was like a talking bear or something, or a firefighter, just characters that were wholly fiction and didn't look anything like me in gender, in age, and things like that. I was always scared to write in the first person for the reason of people assuming that it was memoir, that it was taken fully from my firsthand experience. But I think at some point, the book unlocked itself for me when I did decide I was going to approach this in the first person, that I was going to try to get as deeply into this character's brain as I could. And fiction is a strange blend, I think, of you know, some observation, some imagination, and some indeed like firsthand experience. I think that I've had experiences in failed relationships, as Ruth has. I've had.
I think we all have, except for him.
Well, I did meet her when I was 18. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Everyone except for Mark has had a failed relationship situation. And also, with the caregiving, too, you know, I had insight into that because my grandmother lived at home with my family, my parents and my brothers, and I was actually not her primary caregiver. I would come in and out sort of as I visited my family at home. But I think wanting to really dive deeply into a person's inner life to sort of describe all the maybe mundane things that happened to her was a real interesting endeavor for me. And I wanted to, we talked a little bit about this, but just sort of explore the caregiver's life that isn't normally, I think, I think usually the focus would be on the person with the illness rather than the person who's taking care of that person. And also, I think a lot of your needs, your very human needs and your emotions do have to get pushed aside because this other person that you're caring for has more urgent needs or more immediate needs. And I think this book tries to be sensitive to that, but also wants to explore this woman's life, you know, however not urgent her situation is, you know, because a breakup is bad, but it's not as bad as like losing your mind.
No, let's hope not. Yeah.
At the same time, it is a human experience and one that's worth, you know, considering too. And I think just empathy is a really important part of literature and
humor. And you handle it with a lot of humor. I mean, you balance a lot of, you know, the really sad parts of your story with some really funny things. And that had to be, you know, I think that makes it, it's why it's getting all these best of.
I think it was really important to me that it reflected life. And to me, even when you're in these horrible situations, trying to just stay afloat, there are funny moments that happen, even if they're kind of like funny slash tragic, right? Like something terrible happens, you kind of have to laugh about it. When my grandma was losing her memory, she would often just ask us the same questions over and over again, and we would, just to entertain ourselves, kind of give her different answers, see how she reacted, and then sometimes she would, I don't even want to go into specifics because they are kind of cruel occasionally, but she would answer with a really strong reaction and then 5 minutes later forget completely, ask us the same question. And it was a way for us to
you could sort of measure what was
Now
we've got a specific question from the audience that you, as the author of the book that came from your head, should be able to answer because it's about one of your two of your characters.
This sounds like it's going to be a hard question.
No. But and as the author, you're permitted to come up with the answer here.
Okay.
The graduate student Joan seems quite enamored with Ruth's dad.
Yes.
Are they having an affair? This was a hot topic at our book group.
Oh my God.
Some said yes. Some said this was just a student's crush.
Yes. Well, I don't want to spoil the book for anyone, but and I wanted to leave that vague, actually. So that's that. I'm happy that was a point of discussion at the book club. Mm-hmm. I wanted to leave it vague because I wanted it to seem like perhaps they might have had an affair, maybe they didn't, and we would never know because he doesn't remember.
Ooh, I was convinced that they had an affair.
I can't imagine he would do that to his wife. But.
There we go.
Yeah, there we go. Two different
book club.
Another question that we got from the audience that I was going to ask anyway is, starting with you, Mark, what kind of reaction did you get from everyone, from your wife Julia, from your family, putting all this personal stuff out there? What did Julia think? I know, can you talk about her?
Absolutely,
part
yeah.
of the book?
So, I mean, this is super private and intimate about her, right? And as she always says, if you Google her name, this is what comes up, right? And it's about her health, not mine. And what's been really interesting to see is that she, I think we kind of came to the idea to go public about this separately. She had connected with some friends through her recovery who had opened up to her and sort of shared aspects of her life, that aspects of their lives that she didn't know had happened. And she found that to be, these people became sources of inspiration to her. Like, oh, look, yeah, I didn't know you were hospitalized 15 years ago, but look where you are now. Maybe that can be me. And so I think Julia found tremendous power in the willingness to share your story. And so honestly, since the book has been out, I think she often comes to readings with me, and I've never seen her so empowered before to be able to say, she kind of feels like, I've been hospitalized 3 times. I've got this label for life, but like, I'm still this strong, amazing person who stands here proudly in front of you, you know? My family members were incredibly supportive through the caregiving process as well as the writing process. So they've been just like kind of the ideal cheerleaders in the side rooting for the book. But what's been the most striking and the most humbling by far is the amount of reception I've had from strangers who have... I get emails where it's chilling to read them because it was me, you know, where they're like, I'm in the hospital right now and I came across your writing and I was in that hospital and I was looking for writing. And so it's just like, I mean, it gives me the chills talking about it, you know, it's like, that is so incredible to feel that if there's one person who read this and found a little less fear and loneliness, then I feel like mission accomplished. Like, this whole thing was worth it.
Right. I mean, I think you wrote, there was no handbook for surviving this, and now there kind of is.
I mean, that, I would say yes, but I'm also cautious of that too, because I've learned that even though she has bipolar, everyone's bipolar is so different. Mm-hmm. And so although we have made it together, it's not like that's the only way. Like, I can understand circumstances where a diagnosis would force a relationship apart rather than keep it together. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm saying, if you don't stay together, you have somehow failed. It's like the exact opposite. It's like you need to really be in touch with yourself and the person you love and know what's best for you as a couple, as a partner, but also most fundamentally you as an individual.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, Rachel, both of your books, not both of your books, both of your books, take place chronologically. And his covers a much larger period of time. Yours covers a year. But the structure is fascinating because it's almost diary-like in the way it's arranged. How did you come on that structure?
Yeah,
do you keep a diary?
I don't keep a diary because I've always felt that the diaries, again, that question of what you write down and what you remember, diaries always seem to me really representative of the terrible things that happened to you in your life. You know, I kept a diary when I was a teenager, and my teenage diaries are unreadable. They're just, you would think that my whole life was a torrid, you know, love affair gone wrong, which it definitely was not. It was a lot of homework. But, you know, I don't think the diaries are particularly accurate, and I've never felt compelled to really keep one. But I am interested in this question of memory, right, and what you remember, and maybe having cues to that memory to jog your memory. And so the format kind of came, first of all, because I didn't know how to write a book, and I thought if I wrote little sections, maybe that would become a book eventually. But also, I started keeping this food journal, actually, when I was, it's actually been over 10 years now that I've kept this food log, and it's not anything emotional at all. There's nothing about the day itself. I just like to write down meals that I ate. And the reason that I started doing this was not for like any kind of like restrictive eating type thing, but more because I wanted a really objective way to look back on days. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just write down things that I knew I would encounter every day, you know, like just like January 2nd, like raisins for breakfast, whatever it was. Like, I just thought if I looked back on a really objective list instead of this like overwrought diary entry, I would remember more.
Did it work?
And it's interesting. It does kind of work. It's an interesting exercise. Like, if you're ever interested in like trying to be a better rememberer, it was an experiment that I started that did seem to give me, like, return to me more vivid memories than just writing down, you know, that I was like so sad that day or whatever it was. You know, I could remember, oh, I had this club sandwich with this friend and we talked about this and I felt that way. Almost the same way that, memory just kind of is random you don't get to choose what they are. So I think it's an interesting exercise, and it was sort of one of the reasons that that this diary format emerged, you know, like just this obsession with, like, what do you write down? Why do you write it down? What is the significance? What is it all going to amount to in the end? And it was a big question that I had, that I still have, I think.
And we know that, you know, writing a book, or you know that writing a book isn't just, hey, you wrote this, and here it is, readers, enjoy it. Mm-hmm. There's an editorial process, and did your editors say, but there's no chapters, there's, you know, what is this?
Yeah.
Or were they supportive of the format?
They got it right away. I think that they loved the format. You know, I had edited a lot myself before it even got to their desks. Mm-hmm. So, it's been through every sort of form there is until it, you know, arrived at this one.
And came through pretty good. And what was your process like? I mean, this is, and you can answer a second question from the audience, which is an audience member wants to know, what is the difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
Sure.
And what was your writing and editing process like?
So first off, I'm not an English teacher, I'm a history teacher, but the difference between memoir and autobiography, I think, is that autobiography is more like history. It's really trying to be as factually accurate as possible. And I thought with memoir, I was trying to be as tonally accurate as possible. And since this is such an intimate book, that might mean in certain scenes or certain moments, I know that something actually different happened, but I can still get to that same tone for a reader by changing some of the details. So there certainly is a little bit of that in here, you know? As far as my process, I wrote this New York Times submission on the encouragement from a friend, and then I sat down and tried to write a book, and I had no idea what I was doing.
How long did it take you to write that first article?
The first article I churned out pretty quick, because I was just, it was so, it was this burning intensity of everything, and I just wanted to, like, I had these long, sprawling emails, and I wanted something that was more concise, and I just was able to do it. I don't know why. It just happened. When I was in grad school writing history papers, I would research, 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 and then I would sit down and write a 20-page paper in a day or two, you know? But it was like a month or two of just reading and thinking, and then it's just get it out on the page. So it was kind of like that, too. But as far as getting to the book, the magazine article that was well-read, I actually ended up hiring that editor to help me with the process of constructing a book because I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing. And she was amazing to work with. We actually sat down. I think this also gets to the question of memoir autobiography. She gave me a homework assignment, and she gave me like 200 index cards and said, write every scene that you know needs to be in this book on this index card. And I actually took half of them and I gave them to Julia. And we spent about 2 weeks, and then we compared them, and they were about 80% in common with then some other things. So then I sat down with Liz, my editor, and we, like, 4 hours, just put them on a table and then shuffled around and see what was going to go where. And then it was like, okay, now write this chapter, write this chapter, write this chapter. The last chapter I wrote was the first chapter. It was the hardest chapter to write. It's the one about me meeting Julia when we were 18 and falling in love and getting married at age 24 and moving to California and all this, like, fairy tale element. And it was so hard to write because I had gone through the horror story.
So part, many other things.
Right? So I really struggled with that. And at first it was really long, and then it was really short. And then it was in the middle. And we, I think that's the one I probably have like 16 versions of that chapter that I work through.
And is there, are there things that were too hard to include in the book?
Absolutely. There are things that are too hard. There's things that are too private too. If you've read the book, you know that tragically one of my wife's friends committed suicide in the course of her recovery. And it's a pretty gripping story to dig into those details. And out of respect for her and her family, we kept it pretty just, we didn't really dig into that. Just didn't feel like the right thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's other things that are, I still want Julie and I to have secrets too. So those are, we have those still.
That's great. Yeah. So, Rachel, what was your process like writing those?
Yeah.
This first novel?
Well, you know, the whole process from start to finish, I want to say was 7 years. It's kind of surprising and a little bit embarrassing when you see how short the novel is. It's not War and Peace by any means. But it, I, you know, it's a lot of... a lot of living had to go into it. I also wrote it while we were discussing how the sort of process for fiction and nonfiction is quite different. For nonfiction, you write a proposal, you sell the proposal, you get a book deal. For fiction, you have to just write the book and then hope that somebody buys it. And if not, that's just 7 years of your life down the drain. But, you know, bettering yourself as a person, I suppose. So, you know, I was working on the book while I was working my full-time job, which was as an editor at a magazine. It was pretty challenging because that's an exhausting job, deadlines after deadlines, and also I was doing writing, then trying to write after work, after my job writing. So I had to really... you know, get on a schedule of writing in the mornings and just trying to write whenever I could. Every vacation that I took from the magazine was to work on my novel and to finish it. So that was the process. It was really like long and very unglamorous. I really cherish like the moments when writing feels easy and when it just flows out of you, just like, you know, you said that essay. Mm-hmm. I think those are the special moments that you sort of like write for. But a large portion of this book was really just me sitting at the computer, feeling despair, and often deleting more than I wrote. So I'd have like a negative word count for the day. And it's all part of the process, you guys. It's all fine.
So let me ask you, Mark, you've got a young son.
Yep.
How has he been with this? Is he aware of?
He's really mad that he's not on the cover, but our dog is.
Well, dog got there first.
Yeah. So Jonas was 5 months old when Julia was hospitalized for the second time, and then he was 2.5 when she was hospitalized for the third time. And he knows that this book is about our family. He knows that this book is about mom getting sick. But I don't, like what you were saying earlier, Rachel, how like parents have memories that their children don't have. I don't think he remembers too many specifics. He's 5.5 now. And to be honest, I don't want to go digging at those because I don't want to necessarily plant memories that he's been able to let go of, which I hope he's been able to let go of. But a big thing that I've learned about supporting someone with a mental illness is that it needs to be an inclusive approach. And so right now, Julie and I feel really aligned that if she has a relapse, that I'm going to honor her wants and needs and she's going to honor mine as well. But right now we're speaking on behalf of our child because we don't think he's old enough yet to process those and articulate those. But we're very much aware that as he gets older, we want to include him in those conversations. It's important for him. If he, God forbid, Julia gets hospitalized again, if he wants to go visit her, I might have to let him go visit her even though I don't want him to, right?
Right.
And so I need to be able to have those conversations with him. But as of right now, we're still not really sure when that is. I mean, he's in kindergarten, so we know we have time. And at some point, he's going to read this thing, but we don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know when that is yet either. But I know that it's going to happen, and we want to be open about this. We really want him to feel included, that it's not just like swept away and something he realizes when he's 21 that this was going on in the background. Because I think then he's going to say, but I wanted to be there. I wanted to be, like, I could have handled this, you know? So I think that's just going to be a messy process of figuring out as we go through it.
Okay. We're going to move back to an audience question. And back to one about the book.
Sure.
So, Rachel, tell us about the decision you made to have your dad teach a class. Or no, see, it says your dad. It actually
Ruth's
says
dad.
Your dad. Ruth's dad, not her dad. Her dad probably said, this is not me.
My dad is a civil engineer.
But to have Howard teach a class at the college outside of the system, where did that come from? Did you just think this is something that would be, did you read about that? Like someone doing that?
Oh, no, I don't know. I just imagined it.
Because it's fun. I mean, it's this sort of caper that they
do. So the premise is that, you know, Ruth's father, Howard, is losing his memory, has sort of had some outbursts at school, and so the dean asks him not to teach anymore. But the students in his class see that he's really sad about not teaching for the semester, so they stage a class for him, and they just meet in whatever available empty halls there are. For example, this one. They would come in here and just pretend that he was teaching a real class, when in fact it wasn't an actual class, and they were kind of like dodging the dean at every turn. But I don't remember why that, you know, I was just actually really thinking hard about these characters and thinking, like, what would make Howard happy? Mm-hmm. You know, what would, like, lift his spirits and Ruth and these students figure this out? Because he does love teaching, and this is his, like, great passion.
How do you feel like you left these characters? Was it hard to, like, leave them? Because you... I mean, if you worked on this for 7 years, you got to know these characters so well.
Yeah.
And was it difficult to say, okay, that's...
Yeah, well, you know, the book started because I wrote a story with Ruth as its protagonist, and I loved her voice so much I wanted to keep writing in it. But I always knew that I wanted the book to only span a year. I wanted it to not have any huge life events in it, for nobody to die or get married or... you know, anything crazy to happen. I wanted it to reflect life and just the little moments that happen between people. And so when the year ended, you know, at Christmas, I was happy to leave them. And I, like we've been talking about, I did not, like, sit down, write the book from start to finish. I was almost, you know, maybe a little sick of them by the point I was done, you know, because I had been with them for so long.
Could you anticipate revisiting these characters?
I don't think so.
No?
You know, this is their story and, like, you know, a really specific snapshot of their lives. And you're just going to have to imagine what happens to them, you know, next.
And I think we will. Now, there's a bunch of questions here for Mark, and I'm trying to filter through them. One of them is actually, it's a really interesting question that I don't know if you'll have the answer to, but in the book you talk about living in the foggy and overcast Sunset District in San Francisco, and that the episodes of extreme depression occurred in September, October, November, and January. And the questioner wonders, could the lack of sunlight have triggered these episodes? And now that you don't live there, do you think that's been helpful for Julia?
That's a really interesting question. As far as the weather is concerned, I'm not sure if there's a connection, because episode 3 was when we were in the sunny East Bay. As far as the seasons, absolutely. Julia was her hospitalizations have always been in the fall, September, October. And it's uncanny how predictable it almost is. And it, in fact, it has us that we are on edge in the fall. You know, we're very hopeful that things go okay, but we're both more gentle to each other, but also more cautious of each other. Because if she's maybe staying up a little late, I have to be really careful about how I talk about that with her. Because if I say it wrong, she might get very defensive and, what do you mean? Are you scared? Are you worried? Do I need to worry? And it can lead to a problem. And similarly, I think she needs to be really sensitive that I'm very worried about a relapse and what that would mean. So I would say one of the biggest things I've learned about mental illness is I'm never going to actually understand why this stuff all happens. And I spent so much agonizing time. In fact, I originally wrote a chapter that was just dedicated to me painfully searching for an answer of why and never finding one. And I got that out of the book, but it's because I've made peace that I'm not going to know. It's just our brains are too complicated to know. And so we're just going to try to handle the moments as they come and support the symptoms as they come or as they don't come, and just try to take it, I don't want to say day by day, because we still obviously want to think about the future, but certainly in the fall, we feel like we're taking it day by day.
Now in the book, you know, you have a long bike ride, a vow of silence. It doesn't, if you haven't read the book, it doesn't turn out quite the way he'd hoped, I think.
No, it doesn't.
But yeah, you'll get there. But so you sort of had your own, and probably still have your own ways that you sort of cope as a caregiver and bring, you know, keep yourself centered. I'd love to hear what you're still doing. And someone in the audience wanted to know if you'd ever discovered the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Yeah.
Which does provide peer support.
Yeah. So I am my whole life I was a pretty naturally happy-go-lucky, upbeat guy. And I thought that happiness was the easy default. And I didn't really realize how much you have to work to find your happiness until Julia got sick. And that's when it was actually just kind of in a matter of a combination of boredom and frustration that after a month of her being home out of the hospital and falling asleep really early, I kind of trusted that she was going to sleep through the night. So I would go on these runs on the beach in the middle of the night by myself just to get this energy out. And because I'm a very kinesthetic, active person, and I turned to surfing. Today, even though it's been 3.5 years since I've been in an active caregiving role, I schedule on my calendar time, and it's an appointment, and it's with Mark, and that's it. And no one's allowed to bother me, and I most of the time go, my school that I teach at's at the base of Mount Diablo, so I mostly go running on Mount Diablo in that time. It's just time to get away. Because even though I'm not in acute caregiving, I think in teaching I'm still in a nurturing dynamic. I think as a father I'm still in a nurturing role. And so I've learned that if I'm not checking in with myself and taking care of myself and giving myself relief, I'm not going to be able to be the best husband, father, teacher, son, friend, or whatever it is when I'm called on and needed.
Now, Rachel, I kind of skipped over you when we were talking about reactions to the book. What have your reactions been? What have you gotten from the public?
Yeah, I've been really... It's been really special to hear from, I mean, it's crazy that people read the book. It's this thing that I had been working on for years alone. And I feel like we are very different, have different jobs, you know, like year-round young people all day. I'm a writer alone in a room with a computer screen. And it sounds very basic, but it was just a crazy surprise that other people would read the book and that strangers would read the book and bring to it whatever experiences they had had, you know, that they were going to have an experience with my book in the same way that I had read other people's books in the past and, like, identified with them, related to them, whatever it was. But that was really special to just see, I think, people who look really different from me, who have lived really different lives, being able to read the book with an open mind and to see something of themselves in it or to see a person that they loved in it. And that's been really, really great. I also love the number of book clubs who have read my book and made microwave mug cakes. That has been a delight.
There is a lot of food in the book, you know. And you've mentioned that, you know, your other job was you know, editing a food magazine.
Did
you have to keep yourself from putting too much food? Did you put more food? Were you very selective about what the food you put in?
People keep asking me about food, and I honestly, to be honest, I just thought I was putting a normal amount of food in the book. I just thought, like, I'm going to represent how often normal people think about food. But I think that I maybe think about food more often than the average person. It's really, I've gotten actually both responses. I've gotten people who are surprised that there's not more food in it and people who are surprised by how much food there is. So I think everyone is, again, just a reminder that we're all different and our thoughts are in different places at all times. Mine are frequently with what I'm going to eat next.
Now, do you have any advice for first-time authors who are sort of where you were?
I think just hearing Mark talk to you, books are both really daunting and not at all complicated. They're just a bunch of words. So if you're an author trying to be a first-time author, just know that a book is only a bunch of words. And, like, you know, if you can manage to accumulate words, you'll have a book. So I think just making sure that you actually do write, because I think I actually did have some pretty long periods of not writing, feeling like I couldn't write. But when I actually committed to working for at least an hour every day, or, you know, just setting the timer on my phone and trying to write for that 1 hour. Even if I wrote 10 words in a day, that would become something more. So I think just remember that zero words times whatever is still zero. But if you write one word for 1,000 days, you have 1,000 words. You can do it.
One word for 1,000 days. Okay. three years.
Then you have a short story.
And
50 more.
Double that, and you'll have a book.
Yeah.
So, the titles of your books are really interesting. I think I like them both. Mark's yours probably wins the eyebrow raising. Like what? What's that called?
Yeah.
Where'd the title come from? Did you get...
No, I didn't come up with the title. The reality is the title was by a magazine copy editor. There was the magazine article at first in print is called Crazy in Love. And then when they put it online, they called it My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. And then my agent and publisher, who I got because of that magazine article, they said, you have no choice. This is what they literally called it, a golden ticket title, because it is so provocative. And it took Julie and I a little while to get comfortable with it. We wanted something that was maybe a little bit less in your face.
Mm-hmm.
But I've grown to really love it because I think it shows, it opens with what I think is a fitting characterization of Julia as lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you what's at the core of the story. And then it also is connected to another part of advocacy that I didn't talk about before, which is that we should be talking about mental health. And these are not stories we should bury in our closets, but we're going to put them out there and put them on the cover and let you know exactly what you're getting into.
And do you have any input into the design?
So the design, the cover of this, when we were living in the Sunset and my Julie was post-hospitalization at home, my dad was visiting and we were just on a walk on the beach and my dad just took a picture of us. And this was I don't know if there was something about this picture I'm wearing. I used to be a beach lifeguard, so I'm wearing my beach lifeguard sweatshirt. And there was just something about it that worked and it just captured it. And in non-color, it's like almost all gray. So when the publisher was asking, like, do you have images or something, we sent him this, and they were like, that's it, no question about it, we're going to go with that picture.
Does your dad get a nickel every time a book sold?
He gets a high five. no, but he does have he has credit, so that's pretty cool, you know? Yeah, he's a credited photographer.
And you got a great, you know, pop art book jacket, fun title. How did all this come about for you?
Oh, well, I don't know. I'm not even really sold on my own title, but...
what does it mean to you?
It comes from, it comes from a scene in the book where the father is taking some vitamins and he says, hello, water, goodbye, vitamin. There's a lot of a lot of the characters in the book talk to inanimate objects, sort of out of desperation at times, but... I, for a long time, actually called it Hello Vitamin. I changed it at the very last moment because I wanted it to have more of that melancholic, like, farewell kind of feeling to it. But I do think that in the end, you're asking about the cover, like, mm-hmm. It all sort of goes together because it's kind of mysterious, but also looks like a fun book, which I hope that it is. You know, it's like kind of fun, but also addresses a lot of really sad things. And there are a lot of hard topics that come up in it. And I think that the cover's appropriately confusing.
It's life.
Way. It's
right.
Life.
It's
yeah.
life. And it's all kind of there. So we're getting close to winding up, but I wanted to ask you, what are you working on now? So, Rachel?
Oh, well, I am working on a new novel that I can't talk about yet because I just don't know what it is, but I can say that it's very different from this one. It's a lot longer, and there are a lot more characters, and it spans a lot more time.
Does it have chapters?
It does have chapters. Yeah, we'll see. it's a lot more plot-driven. And another thing that I'm working on that is actually taking up most of my time right now is a business that I just started, and it's based in San Francisco. It's a workspace for women writers and artists. It's called The Ruby.
Ooh,
and
okay.
Literally just opened last week, so I'm very tired.
So you're in startup mode, basically, right now.
I'm in startup mode, and it's entirely... member funded as well, so it's a very bootstrappy operation, but it's exciting because it's a chance, you know, I was kind of touching on the loneliness of a writer's life. It's a way for writers to get together and have a community.
And that's really important. I mean, mm-hmm. when you can have your book points that out too, just having a community, having a network.
Yeah.
Now, you don't want to write a sequel to your book.
I do not.
But
no.
We've had a lot of comments tonight saying they love the way you write. They love the descriptive nature of your writing. They're saying you're a writer.
Well, that's very humbling.
They would like you to take some more time to write. Do you have plans to do that?
Well, most of my writing these days are grade reports or course descriptions.
I bet you have the best course descriptions,
yeah.
Don't you?
But, so I actually, very fun news to share is that Julia is 7 months pregnant. And thank you. And so my school has granted me the permission to take all next year off to be the stay-at-home father. which I'm ecstatic for. And so I think if I was to write anything else, it would probably be about fatherhood, because mm-hmm. that is, of all the things that I've done, which I'll be honest, they feel pretty vocational to me. I think parenting feels the most vocational to me. But otherwise, what I'm working on is a new smartphone policy on campus for teenage use. You know, that's what my days are like.
What do your students think about having a celebrity?
It's a little awkward sometimes, but I didn't know this, but high school kids Google their teachers. I certainly don't go in and be like, hey, kids, welcome to class.
Yeah. You know? Your assigned reading this year is.
But they find it, and it's actually been really amazing. When a student finds it, they often want to tell me personally that they've come across my work and liked it and appreciate it. And that actually often becomes an invitation to have a more meaningful relationship with them, where I think I've had a lot of students and parents both feel like that maybe they look at like a fellow traveler mm-hmm. if they're going through some sort of challenges in their own home, which they wouldn't have otherwise known if this book wasn't out there.
Well, we've gotten a lot of comments like that from the audience. We're going to close right now, but I do want to read you two of those. They're directed at Mark, but I think they apply. That having several family members deal with mental illness, I remember walking the walk with your descriptions. The loneliness was overwhelming. Thank you for your insight. And then specifically to Mark, this person says, how in the world did you keep together? You went through so much. I've concluded after reading your book that you have a love like no other. So I think that says a lot.
Whoever said that, thank you very much.
Everyone's been very touched by both your books. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I am Nancy Howe, the County Librarian for Santa Clara County Library District and co-chair of Silicon Valley Reads. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, and we look forward to seeing you at more Silicon Valley Reads events in February and March.